Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Podcast. My name is Sam Snelling. We are here for a brand spanking new episode of Dive Cuts. I believe this is season 4, episode 18. With me, as always, our friend, big Jesse Newell supporter, and an all around good guy, Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are you?
I feel great.
Great.
I'm just so glad that Jesse is ranked Missouri now.
25th.
And Missouri fans will now respect him, and they will leave him alone and just not pester him anymore. They're going to handle this.
I feel like they need to direct all of their hate and ridicule towards the B-Predict guy or whatever. I don't even know who that guy is, but I even said on Twitter the other night, I don't know if you saw it, I have a lot of respect for Jesse. I think his method, while I kind of disagree with it, I'm glad he sticks with it. I do think that there need to be a lot more voters who do look at metrics. I just think Jesse's kind of misapplying the metrics. But that's fine. I don't hate on the guy. We had a respectful conversation, and I like what he said. The other guy was just an asshole. And he just keeps getting more mad and more mad. And Mizzou fans, all they do is post pictures of Gonzo Martin, which I think is hilarious. But as I said on Twitter, if he'd have handled it at all like Newell did with a little bit of grace, this would be over. But he went into his bunker and he cried and whined, and now the smoke just keeps filling the room for him. So. I don't mind it. I don't mind it at all. You sort of reap what you sow.
Oh, other than that, I feel just fine at this point.
Missouri. So AP poll came out today. Missouri was ranked 10th, which is kind of cool. Top 10. Another sort of kicker for Mizzou fans is the fact that your most hated rival, Kansas, fell out of the AP poll for the first time since 2009. That's crazy. Crazy.
But the other thing is people stunting on KU without ignoring the fact that they'd been in the poll for a dozen years. I saw Mark's tweet, we should hang up the Mizzou's ranking and then show that Kansas is in the receiving votes category. No, that just confirms what Kansas fans say all the time, which is Missouri's just happy to be here, and KU's a fixture. When a program's won 13 conference titles in a row and hasn't left the AP top 25 in a dozen years, I get Schadenfreude and rivalries, but just understand that when you're ripping on Kansas, they're fine. They've had a lot of. There's a lot of achievements in the last dozen years that they can console themselves with. So, it's one of those years too where I think you're seeing the impact of what the investigation into the program to the West has
absolutely.
Is reaping for them.
Yeah.
Like this is a good core that you put around two other really good dudes.
Yeah. Like,
and
if
KU's wrecking shop.
If you're building, yeah, if you're building your roster around, you know, and no offense to Parker's brother, but like, you know, Christian Brown and Ochai Agbaji and guys like that, who, you know, I would be more than happy if those guys were on Missouri's roster. I think they're really good players. But I also don't think if they're on Missouri's roster, they'd be Missouri's best players. Like, they're really, really good college basketball players. And that's, Kansas is used to kind of having, you know, an elite guy or two. And even if Bill's able to kind of develop those guys, like you look at, you know, at Shane Graham or Frank Mason, guys that weren't supremely highly rated, but still turned into college All-Americans. And they haven't really been able to kind of get those guys. And the investigation plays a role. But this is not a Kansas podcast. We do like to rib them, and I do think it's hilarious that, you know, the day that Missouri sort of gets into the top 10 is the day that, you know, Kansas falls out of the poll completely. And the tweet that I published for Rockin' Nation, Matt, I believe is still going. It's got like 200 something retweets, like over 1200 likes.
It's caught the zeitgeist.
It's been a while since a Rockin' Nation tweet has been that popular. I think it's kind of a minor miracle. I think fans are excited for Missouri basketball for a change, and so here we are. So we're coming off a successful week. I think we kind of looked at it and thought, hey, like, you still are probably feeling pretty good if you go 1-1, and Missouri went 2-0. It was sort of an unorthodox way of getting to 2-0. They handled Kentucky. It was probably a little closer of a score than I think a lot of people would have liked. You know, but I feel like they did what they needed to do. It did have a little bit of like an older brother, little brother, even though, like, you would in most cases kind of consider Kentucky the older brother. Missouri is by far the more mature team. And it did sort of feel like, you know, they were just doing just enough to make sure they were able to kind of hold Kentucky at bay. Alabama was a completely different animal. I'm sure everybody that listens to this podcast, or most of you, probably watched the game. You watched this terrific lead get built up, and you saw it get whittled down to a single point. Panic sets in. Missouri was able to hold on with you know, three defensive stands in a row, and really kind of get the job done. So congrats to them. They now hold three wins this season over teams that were in the AP top 10 at the time that they played them. Those wins are Illinois, Tennessee, and Alabama. Two of those at home, one of those on the road. So successful season keeps on rolling, Matt. The Tigers are 13-3. You have any major takeaways from the Kentucky game, or you just want to just kind of gloss right over and right into Alabama?
Oh, we can gloss over the Kentucky game. Outside of
It's only Missouri's second all-time program win against Kentucky.
I'll say this about the Kentucky win. Missouri did what it needed to do against a program where the worst-case scenario has played out on almost every front, outside of a six-minute window where fouls quickly piled up on them. They had to try and triage it. Kentucky took advantage of that little block of time. Outside of that, it was Missouri, I think, that had like a +15 scoring margin. I mean, it was not... That six-minute span made the game appear much closer than it was. And, you know, you talk about Missouri holding on late. Missouri made, enough plays throughout the remaining 14 minutes or so. Every time Kentucky got it down to 7 or 8, or even, like, maybe 6, Missouri made a couple plays, extended it back out. Kentucky had to try and push the rock back up the hill again. And then you saw...
And for a team that is as bad as Kentucky has been all year long in like the final 4 minutes, they did exactly what they've done all year in the final 4 minutes, which is basically piss down their leg.
Yeah, and so you can talk about Missouri finding a way to win. I think they did what they needed to do and held serve.
Well, Kentucky also shot 45% from three-point range in that game. And this is a team who is actually on the year shooting worse than Missouri is from three-point range. So they came out with their best shooting performance, and they still lost by five.
Yeah, it was... It is what it is. The Alabama game is more interesting to talk about. Mostly because
you and I spent probably 15 minutes before the podcast, you know, talking about this game.
I think what frustrated me about that game was that 7 days earlier you saw what happened when a team backs off the throttle and you take advantage. It was just infuriating.
And you're talking about, you know, how TCU really kind of changed their own, you know, pace of play and allowed Missouri to get right back into the game.
Yeah. Just open the door, and you and I talk about it or allude to it. Just keep playing. Like, don't get too risky, but you were doing things well. You had a game plan. You were executing it. Just keep doing it and make Alabama stop you.
Yeah,
I don't understand. You can argue that they had, you and I think that they started to kind of ease off the throttle. 12 minutes left. Some fans would disagree and say, oh, they didn't really chop the lead down until the final six. Whatever. The last 6 minutes were clearly not, Missouri was not operating off the same script that it had for the first 34 of that ball game.
Yeah.
And you could watch it in when they were running their half-court sets. It was not the same approach that they had to build that lead. And I get frustrated, and this will see again to kind of my weekly rant about why people shouldn't be mad at KenPom. KenPom is going to like look at every possession you play. KenPom doesn't go, oh, those first 28 minutes when you were kicking their ass, we're going to weigh those more heavily than the last 12 of you where you were just kind of bunkering. No, you make a decision to try and sit on a lead. Those possessions still count. And I just get frustrated when people want to act like there's some sort of bias or act like these metric systems don't make sense when Missouri made a conscious decision in that basketball game to try and sit and try and bleed clock and not value possessions in a certain way, which is to score points. When they became risk-averse in their approach to possessions, the results of that approach are now reflected in their KenPom rating. It's not bias. It's not a screwed-up algorithm. It's a reflection of the decisions you make while the game is playing and from possession to possession. So,
I brought up also, you know, as we were kind of chatting today about how, you know, football, and for those who, you know, follow our former leader Bill Connolly, know that he has like garbage time statistics, which factor into a team's rating much more so than, you know, than basketball. So basketball doesn't do that. You know, each possession is valued the same. So if you have a 50-point lead, and you put your five walk-ons in the game, and then they give up 20 points and don't score, KenPom is going to look at the entirety of the game, and we really like KenPom's algorithm. Like, it's not Ken Pomeroy. Ken is a great guy. He was very smart analysis or data analyst when it comes to this stuff. You know, Bart Torvik is another guy. Same kind of thing. You know, it's not their ranking system. It's a ratings algorithm that is trying to predict outcomes, basically. Like, that's how KenPom got into this whole system, was to try to match as closely as he could what Vegas was basically already doing in determining, like, what the odds are going to be going into a game. And that's what came into his system and really sort of birthed or helped birth the data analysis, you know, boom in college basketball. So I think what we don't get is you don't get like version A of Missouri, where they're playing and attacking and you know, really trying to just win the game as much as possible, versus, you know, passive Missouri, who is just trying to, you know, get to the end of the game. And there are kind of two different teams that we've seen at times where when they're fast and aggressive and you know, and attacking the rim and getting to the backboard and all that kind of stuff, like, Missouri's one of the best teams in the country. But what is holding them back from being rated as one of the best teams in the country, and instead just, you know, being barely in the top 30, or I think they're 20th in Torvik's ratings. What's holding them back is all those other possessions where they do kind of look lost, and they don't play as aggressively, and you know, they're trying to elongate possessions as opposed to, you know, just continuing to attack early and doing the things that kind of got them ahead in the first place. And so one of the things that I kind of wanted to talk about with this Alabama game is, you know, I do think it's important, because I was kind of reading Rockentology. I think Sammy's doing an awesome job with those, kind of putting together like a biweekly thing where we can get an idea of where Missouri is going to fall in the bracket based upon all the brackets that are available. And I do think that there was some commentary where people are like, oh, well, you know, like, I'm worried about like Missouri's ceiling or whatever. And it's just like, they're talking about, you know, Mizzou's ability to sort of make it deep into a tournament. And you know, like, March is like a fickle, fickle thing. And it is for everybody. Like, it's really, really hard to win an NCAA tournament. Especially this year. I think right now what we're kind of looking at is there's two elite teams, right? Everybody considers Gonzaga, Baylor, two elite teams. There's probably, well, like eight.
Michigan, Ohio State, Villanova, Illinois, Houston, Virginia, Iowa, like kind of in that.
Yeah, I mean, there's like this group of eight-ish.
Eight or nine.
Yeah, teams that you're like, all right, those teams are really good and can make a Final Four. I don't know that I consider Missouri to be in that group, but I know that Missouri has beaten three teams who at one point I considered to be in that group. Like, I've hedged since on Tennessee. I still think that defensively they're as good as you can get, but, you know, the ball handling is like it was beginning of the season. It was a major concern. You know, maybe Springer playing more, they're going to figure it out. Who knows? If they do, they're in that group of eight teams. You know, but Missouri's beaten Alabama and Illinois, who are in that group. So is Missouri capable of putting together the right kind of run to get to a Final Four? Yeah. Are they likely to? Not really, because as well as they are capable of playing at times, they're also capable of not playing well. They're capable of playing the way that they do against Bradley. If you come out and play like second half of Mississippi State, the whole game of Bradley, large portions of the game against TCU, the Tennessee. Tennessee last 5 minutes against Alabama, then you are not going to beat a team in the Elite Eight
or in the Sweet 16.
But Missouri has beaten the kinds of teams that they are likely to face in a Sweet 16. So
I don't think
that's not like a guarantee that like they're an Elite Eight team. The issue with this season, and I've been saying this all along, is we're going to see even more wild variants of outcomes because of the situation that everybody is playing in. And I think that Missouri has been as consistent as almost anybody. The problem is everybody's inconsistent except for Gonzaga and Baylor.
You're going to run into an issue where when I looked at I mean, I look at bracket matrix and I tend to look at where Missouri moves in like the day or two after a win. Like usually there's about 25 to 30 bracketologists that will update, and those are the most recent results, and that's a good enough sample. That's probably 40% of the people in that bracket matrix tracks, and I look at their average seed. Missouri's been moving over the last 3 weeks between 3.1 and 4.5 in the immediate aftermath of games. So it's, when you're looking at what Missouri's seed line is, and we're talking about ceilings, I kind of think they're already there, barring Bama slipping and Missouri reeling off 7 more wins in a row and they get to 13-3 and Bama opens the door for them.
Right.
Then maybe you talk about a 2 or a 1, but...
I don't think that they have... One, I don't think the SEC is competent enough.
No.
But yeah, even if Missouri like went undefeated the rest of the way, like they don't have what it takes to get to a 1 seed. Like their resume isn't good enough, and the remaining games in their schedule aren't good strong enough.
Now, if they get breaks and there's some cannibalizing that happens in the Big Ten, maybe a two. But what you're seeing right now with the results in hand, with most of their quad one games, in the rear view, probably a 3. So the question then that you ask is, how good of a job will the committee do at seeding teams? Because if they're going to go, what they've said is they're going to follow the S curve pretty hard here. And in the past, they could have, when they were doing regional sites, the prevailing factor was distance. They would try and avoid conference matchups, and they'd try and shorten travel distance. Now that we're doing 4 or 5 bubbles in Indiana, they're going to just S-curve it. So you're really now looking at where are teams falling on that S-curve, and how accurate is that? Now, if you're believing that they're going to use net as their tool... We've talked about how this year, while we believe predictive metrics are really, really good and really, really valuable, it's a wonky year for everything. So are you going to wind up with some variance in seeding? Are you going to wind up with a team like Loyola Chicago or Drake that's underseeded? Are you going to wind up with a Big Ten team that gets underseeded by a couple of lines and suddenly you're getting a team that should be a 4 or a 5 seed on the 6 or 7 line, and you're facing them in the second round as a 2 or a 3 or a 4 seed? So that's really the question I think you're going to run into is, are you going to have some seed line issues that come into play? So that's going to impact the ceiling as much as Missouri playing is what the committee does and how they sort of look at the resumes this year and put teams on that S curve. But as far as what Missouri's ceiling is, they're there. The quality win opportunities are mostly gone. I was looking at this earlier. Ole Miss is technically a quad one win. Arkansas will straddle the quad one, quad two line. And if Florida can keep its act together, that'll be a quad one win. So you maybe have 2 to 3 more quad one win chances. Probably 2. And after that, it's 4 quad 2 games, and then A&M is quad 3. Missouri, if they go 2-0 this week, would potentially be 6-3 in Q1 games and 9-3 against Q1 and Q2. There's just not enough left to juice the resume outside of winning the SEC tournament.
Right.
So if you're looking at ceiling, that's really where we are at this point.
Yeah, they pretty much... just kind of looking at the rest of the schedule, there's 2 games that can really kind of help their seed line, and basically a host of games that will only maintain it or hurt it.
Yeah.
So, and even like the home game against Arkansas is like, that's debatable whether it would help them. I think you could probably make a strong case that it would help them sort of hold. But a road win at Florida would certainly... I don't know that it would give them a boost. It might, take them from, being like the third 3 seed team to like the first 3 seed team or something like that.
Because at that point they're going to have if you get through this week undefeated, you're as close to a lock as possible. And I know that's going to scare Missouri fans or a segment of them. But if you're 15-3, 8-3 in your conference with a 6-3 record in Q1 games and 9-3 against Quad 1 and Quad 2, you're a lock. Barring an epic collapse, you're still going to make the field. You're not going to be a great seed, but
yeah,
like, you take care of business this week. Say you pick off Georgia. There's no damage you can do in those final four games to take yourself out of the field.
Yeah.
So we're basically 1 week away, a productive week away from saying Missouri's probably as close to a lock as you can get at this point in mid-February. And then you're playing to lock down your seed line, but as you said, there's not much outside of a SEC tournament run that can juice their seed line anymore. So you're starting to see it. It's probably a high three seed, and then you're just rooting for the bracket to break your way.
So this this Alabama game, a lot was kind of made of the meltdown. And so you and I kind of talked about this before the pod, but I kind of wanted to revisit it for the listeners because I think this is sort of an interesting topic. So the final run, if you break it all down, was about 21-2. It obviously was some scary times for Missouri. That lead evaporated in a hurry. The amazing thing to me is, other than that 21-2 run, that Alabama did not have another run the entire game. So a run is typically 6-0. So where you have scored 6 straight points or more. And then as it gets up, it gets kind of like, I guess it's sort of interpretive. but it starts at 6-0. Alabama did not have a single run outside of that 21-2 run. They put together five-oh spurt, and then several other 4-0 spurts, but nothing was basically longer than 4 or 5 points, other than their 21-2 run. Missouri actually went on 2 7-0 runs and an 8-0 run in the first half. So that's 14. That's 22-0 total. A second half run. That was the end of the first, beginning of the second half. That was 12-3, and then another 6-0 run in the second half. So if you just tallied all those up, it ends up being like 40-3, of runs that Missouri had. Now, granted, interspersed in there is probably several times where Alabama's kind of running off 4 points in a row several times. So obviously it's not 40-3 all at once. But if you would you rather be the team that had 40-3 total runs or 21-2? I think most people would take that 40-3.
The other way I look at it is, in the first 10 minutes, Missouri outscored Bama, or in the first 10-11, 32-18, so plus 14. Bama closes with that massive run down the stretch, so you're at minus 5 there. Missouri basically won the middle 20 minutes of that game by 8 points. And the bulk of that was during that run that kind of overlapped the first and second half.
Yeah.
So it was, that's kind of how I approached it. Now, the issue is how that Bama run happened. As we mentioned earlier, I don't credit Bama for taking advantage of the opportunity, but I think Missouri, in some ways, left the door open for them. And listen, it's not my job. I've written this several times. I don't get paid $3 million a year to make these sort of executive decisions, but it seemed Missouri backed off the throttle, particularly probably with 6 or 7 minutes to go, and just decided we're going to try and sit on the ball, we're going to try and bleed some clock, and you mentioned it when we were talking before, that plays into Bama's hands because Bama's a team that's not... They're a pack line team with a bunch of length that wants to get in gaps, and they will try and poke the ball away. And when Missouri's trying to run its offense and trying to bleed down clock, you're just letting Bama load up. And what Missouri was doing well, I thought, in the first half was, aside from, you know, pushing off long misses and trying to get in transition, they were just attacking with a little bit more urgency earlier in the clock. They were running the same kind of actions, but they were running them with just a little bit more pop, a little bit more pace. And there was, I think there was just a little bit more urgency in how they were operating in the half court. I didn't see that down the stretch. You mentioned it, and I saw it as well. There were several possessions where it seems like Pinson wasn't following the diver the way he was in the first half to really get into the heart of that defense. It seemed as if Missouri sort of said, let's just try and land the plane. You know, if Bama chips it, that's fine. And Bama showed what Missouri did, kind of mimicked what Missouri did against TCU. It didn't just kind of passively take it. It tried to get back in the ballgame, and then it ramped up pressure on Missouri. I think Bama goes on a 6-2 spurt. They get the lead down to 13. They come out of the under 4, and then they spring the press. And that, to me, changed the complexion of the game. Bama, between 5-10 and about 2 minutes to go in that 3-minute stretch, asserted itself, and Missouri just didn't find a way to stop that run or to stanch that momentum. And it almost cost them.
What's funny is, like, I even kind of read a few, you know, comments along the way, which always happens anytime a team presses Missouri and a comeback ensues. You know, it is sort of blamed that the press was to blame. The press breaker wasn't working, and it felt like, you know, and it does. It feels like in the moment when there's a press that there's a little bit of panic. Missouri didn't turn the ball over against the press.
No.
Their turnovers, and I think they had two turnovers in that stretch, were in the half court. Yep. They had broken the press. I think Drew Smith had one where he just got his pocket picked. I think there was another kind of sloppy turnover around the baseline.
Yeah.
But what the press does... And what I think it was effective at doing, and this is something I was actually going to bring up, you know, why Missouri was successful against Alabama early is because they didn't let their defense get set. Alabama gets a lot of credit for wanting to play fast, and they do play very fast on offense.
They play slow on defense.
But they play slow on defense. They're 246 in tempo on D, and third on offense. So they get the ball, they shoot it quick. But then they really make you work, and they really do want to sit, and like you said, in the pack line. They want to sit back. They want to use their length along the perimeter, and they want to, you know, make you try to move the ball with active hands. And it's tough to do. I mean, even during the game, when Missouri was building their lead, I felt like Missouri had a hard time, you know, in their half court. Once they were able to get the ball past that initial, you know, pack line and drive the ball to the rim, I thought they had success because Alabama doesn't really have, you know, a true rim protector.
Missouri makes good decisions depending on the day. X can do it, but Missouri generally makes good decisions once they get to that second level and how that and their reads and what they want to do there. But the key is, can you crack that second level? And that's what I was talking about. I felt like they were letting Bama load up that side of the floor, particularly when they're running those pick and rolls. It's almost in the slot to a side pick and roll, so you can load your early help. And if when you're spacing that corner, if it's like Mitchell Smith, okay, fine, we'll let you shoot that jumper. We'll flood it. We'll just bring that defender in. We won't defend that weak side corner, and we'll just load it. And that it felt like. At that point, it didn't matter if Bama was long enough, had enough height. You were going to have to drive through four long dudes to get to the rim.
Yeah.
And if you were even going to try and make the right read to dump to Tillman, there's now an extra help defender there. So it just felt – and on top of that, now you're not dictating the terms at which tempo is being played. Bama's pressed you. They've made you bleed an extra 7 or 8 seconds. Now you're having to hustle into your offense. You're not setting good screens. You're not getting good angles. You're not letting Tillman roll out enough to really get that separation to create that path you were chasing. It just felt like Bama dictated the terms of those final 4 or 5 minutes. And Missouri let them do it. Missouri set themselves up to go through that. And again, you know, we're not in the huddle. We're not making those decisions. But that's just what it looked like from my perspective, was they willingly ceded momentum in a game that they had been dominating for 30 minutes.
And I'd also like to point out, I feel like I used to say this a lot more in the past on study halls. I would sort of make, and I guess maybe since Missouri is winning, I don't have to like think about this as much. But Mizzou had his, I mean, we all at this point know Missouri is not a great shooting basketball team. They've had three of their last five games. You could even go to 4 of their last 6, where they've shot 38.5% or better from three, including 3 games that are over 40%. So they've raised their three-point shooting on the season a little bit. I think going into the game, they were a little bit over 30%, 30.1 or 2%, something like that. Missouri shot 15%. They were 3 of 20 from the three-point line. The only game this year where they've shot worse was against Bradley. We all remember that game and how that went. So this is a whole, this is another sort of part of it that Alabama shot their average. They hit 35 or 36%. That's about what they shoot in the season. Missouri shot 15% below their normal mark. So if they make 2 or 3 more threes, and I think I mentioned this before as we were talking, so many times this year it feels like Missouri kind of comes up with that needed jump shot at the right moment in the second half. Maybe a team is creeping back into the game, and you know, Mark Smith's 0 of 6 at this point, but damn it, he hits that one, right? Yeah. And he makes it, and suddenly it's back to an 11-point lead, and Missouri is able to kind of coast the rest of the way in. And I really kind of feel like several of the threes that Missouri took, like they kind of expected those shots to go in, and they just didn't. I feel like Missouri's offense was better against Alabama when they were attacking early in the clock and they were getting to the rim. They didn't do that in that last stretch, and they settled for jumpers. But if one of those jump shots goes in, it's a completely different ballgame. Yeah. And then, you know, like, and I think that's sort of thing. So at any point of the first half, second half, if Missouri just makes a couple more jump shots, like, you know, Alabama's basically pissing in the wind at that point, and it doesn't matter what press they do. It's only when they get that, take that lead from like 13 to 7, I think is sort of like the range where you cut it to that. Now it's like, okay, now we have to start playing again because there's 3 minutes to go and we have a 7-point lead.
Yeah.
But the reality, Missouri just beat a top 10 team at home, and that's a good thing. It's something that didn't happen for Missouri for a lot of years, and now it's happened 3 times this year. So, kind of looking ahead, I think we can pivot out of Alabama unless there's anything I missed.
We mentioned earlier the opportunity at Ole Miss, and this is one of those games that sneaky trap game. Like it, I feel like every time somebody says it's a trap game, that automatically means it's not a trap game because you've recognized it's a trap game. that fun semantic loop there of declaring something a trap game no longer makes it a trap game. But just an interesting matchup, I guess. Ole Miss is ugly on offense, but man, they will make it into an ugly, ugly grinder at the other end of the floor. And it took down Tennessee last week, so there's some risk when you go into Oxford, and there's a scenario under which this thing becomes a slog, and maybe the jumpers aren't falling, maybe there's some turnover issues, and it gets into a tight ball game played in the low 60s, and you don't make enough of those kind of plays you're talking about right now. You don't have one of those jumpers drop, or you bleed out a few too many possessions, and suddenly you're taking a 3 or 4 point road loss. So it's not a trap game, but there's some risk associated with this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ole Miss is a team that they're about what I thought they would be kind of coming into this year.
Yep.
I thought some of the early prognostications were way higher. I think even KenPom at one point had them in the 30s. They looks like they got as high as 33. I never really thought of them as being that good. I just didn't like the roster. I didn't like having to rely on Devontae Shuler. You know, Devontae Shuler he's a guy that, I mean, if you've watched Missouri play Ole Miss at any point in the last 4 years, you remember him. He's a really athletic guard. He's capable of being great. He's also capable of being awful. He's just as likely to, you know, shoot like 6 of 8 from 3-point range as he is to shoot 0 for 6. And so, like, that inconsistency and having to rely on a guy that's sort of been like that, I think, is one of the reasons why I was a little hesitant. You know, and then I was kind of thinking that, you know, Matthew Morrell would be a guy who might kind of come along more later in the year. You know, he's had very little opportunities to kind of, you know, break out. He's just sort of been a guy that they've relied a lot more on Jarkel Joyner, which I don't really think is
a good sign.
I mean, he's a transfer from Cal State Bakersfield, who I think walked on last year as a transfer, and I think he's probably on scholarship this year. But
yeah.
Then you've got KJ Buffin as a guy who I think I've always liked as a complimentary guy, but he's, you know, his usage at this point is like it's about 20% of possessions, and that's just like that's awfully high for a guy with his skill set. So I mean, it makes sense why they're offensively challenged.
This is what I would say. Which of all these transfers that, or all these new additions that were supposedly impactful, has really stood out? It's Romello White, a guy who was a 10-8 dude at another high major program.
Yeah.
It's what we said in the preseason. When you turn to up transfers, you can expect efficiency dips, you can expect production dips, especially if they're making like a jump from a program that was like 100 spots behind their new program in KenPom, which is what was happening with Joyner, which was going to happen with Domencio Vaughn. Remember when everyone was loving Domencio Vaughn? He averages 1 point a game. He barely sees the floor.
He did not play against Auburn.
A game where you would want as many guards on deck as possible.
He played 1 minute against Tennessee, 2 against Georgia, 8 against Arkansas, 4 against Texas A&M.
Meanwhile, you have Matthew Morrell, who was a top 50 high school prospect, but again,
I would have thought he was going to be better than he's been.
He's been good. He's been passable defensively, but offensively, it's been pulling teeth for him. You know,
he hasn't made a 2-point shot since January 23rd.
Like I said, struggle bus. And I think the real disconcerting thing for me would be Austin Crowley. What? And Tavian Collum. Huh. Just where these are sophomores that you would have expected to take some sort of productive leap, because those are going to be the guts of your program moving forward. Romello White's going to be gone. Monte Shuler is going to be leaving. Kadeem Sy is leaving and rotating out. Domencio Vaughn's going to be gone. And now you're going to be having Jarkel Joyner, Matthew Morrell, who's coming off a struggle of a freshman year, Austin Crowley, Luis Rodriguez, and Antavian Collum, and KJ Buffett. Like, I know we should focus on the game coming up, but I think what we're both alluding to is if this was the Ole Miss team that a lot of people thought they were going to see, we wouldn't be having this very conversation. Luis Rodriguez would not be a guy who's getting a ton of run the last five games. A guy whose one offensive skill set is occasionally knocking down a jumper, but is really out there for defensive reasons. Robert Allen is a black hole offensively. Or black hole defensively, I should say. But KJ Buffin's not exactly giving you much either. So it feels like what they're relying on is Devontae Shuler having, you know, clicking that night, Joyner finding some semblance of efficiency, and Romello White being a reliable third option. And then you're hoping for somebody else to step forward. Maybe it's KJ Buffin making some nitty-gritty plays off the glass, on dump-offs. Maybe it's Rodriguez knocking down some more threes than usual. For a team that was supposed to have a bunch of diverse options, they really only have, what, two and a half offensively?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, defensively, they guard their asses off. They execute Kermit's matchup zone kind of press system really, really well.
Yeah, they do a lot of different things.
They'll junk it up, a lot of them well. They force turnovers. They keep you off the glass. They make it a frustrating experience defensively. But you got to score the basketball, and I just don't. I look at the roster, and I don't see three or four guys that can consistently score. And you know who would be nice to have right now? Mr. Blake Henson.
Yeah, about that. Ole Miss is a good defensive team. They're about like, you know, they're a lot closer to Kentucky as far as being a good defensive team versus Alabama or Tennessee.
Yeah.
I still think that the issues that I was concerned about with Ole Miss kind of coming into the season and where they are now, I think this is a game that, very clearly you can go on the road and lose. I mean, Tennessee lost. And, I mean, Tennessee has struggled a lot at times offensively, maybe even more so than Missouri. But, you know, they're still a good team. And they lost at Ole Miss. So I think from that standpoint, I really kind of feel like Martin will have this team ready. I think the maturity of the roster is something that will, I'm sure they remember going down to Ole Miss, last year?
Played well enough and didn't hold on to the ball.
And lost. Yeah. What was it, 2 years ago or 3 years ago they went down there and won?
It was Martin's first year they went down there and won.
So it's a tough place to play. Kermit's a good coach. I think that they're going to be ready, but I don't know that that's going to be enough to win the game. Like, I think there's a reason why this is like a projected 1 point win as opposed to like a projected 5 point win. Like this is a tough team, and if Missouri plays the way that they're capable of defensively, I think that they can do enough on offense, particularly with Jeremiah Tillman, in and around the rim. I think it's kind of time to get Tilly back involved. If that happens, then I think this is a game where, you know, Missouri can win as comfortably as you can expect them to win in Oxford.
Arkansas will be interesting just because they have a key asset back on the floor that they didn't have in the first meeting. Justin Smith is healthy, and I think I pointed this out to you before we hit record. When he's on the floor, Arkansas's net rating is plus 27. When he comes off, it drops to plus 8. We can do subtraction on dive cuts. That's a difference of 19 points per 100 possessions, Sam. That is close to Sharif Cooper territory. Auburn was 21 points better with Cooper on the floor. So I feel like having Justin back is going to make a critical difference going into Saturday.
So, yeah, Arkansas is an interesting team. And I think Arkansas is they're looking about, you know, we were kind of talking before the pod.
They're looking like we thought.
Yeah, they're looking a lot more like we thought they might. Obviously, the start for them was not great. You know, they beat Auburn without Sharif Cooper, and then lost to Missouri and Tennessee, beat Georgia, lost to LSU, Alabama. I mean, that's a stretch of four games.
three on the road, too. Three of them away from home.
Yeah, it's a really tough stretch. And you certainly would have liked to maybe gone like 1-3 as opposed to 0-4, if you're Eric Musselman, you know. But that's sort of the breaks. It's how it went. And so now they've got Kentucky. It's Monday, so they got Kentucky tomorrow night, and then Missouri for the Rally for Ryan game. So both of those games are away. Arkansas has lost three of their last four road games, and the one win was at Vanderbilt. Granted, they beat Vanderbilt by 21 points.
Again, they didn't have Smith for those road losses, though. They're in the stretch of the schedule. I think I projected them to start like 2-5. Well,
they had Justin Smith at Oklahoma State.
That they did. So I will take the mulligan on that one, but.
You will take it. And he did play a little bit against Alabama, but that's his first game back.
He only played
18 minutes. I don't think you would say that he's fully back.
No, he was running mostly with reserve units in that game, so they weren't putting him into full service.
That was an ugly, ugly game for them, too. So I think you could probably sort of wipe that one off the map. That's far more of like outlier for really both teams. I mean, Alabama played really well and Arkansas played really horribly, and that's how you get a 31-point road loss.
What people may wonder, why do you guys care so much about Justin Smith? Defensively, offensively, he's not great in half court. He's actually pretty mediocre in the half court, but he's really great running the floor for them in transition, and Musk wants to play fast. He wants to get them out in the open court, so that's where his value comes offensively. Defensively is where he comes in. We saw it a little bit, Missouri's first trip down to Fayetteville. He covers Connor Vanover in pick and roll defense. Either one, he goes out and he is the big man in their pick and roll coverage, or he's the guy rotating over if Connor can keep the ball in front of him. They did not have that in Fayetteville. It was causing some issues in terms of who was rotating down over, helping, just all kinds of problems for them in ball screen defense. He is strong enough to tag Tillman as a roller, so that is also a big deal because there was not anybody on Arkansas's roster who could really, you know, impede Tilly's path rolling to the rim for lobs. So that's where I think you're going to see his impact show up. Maybe not in the box score offensively, but I think he's going to help them sort of counteract what Missouri wants to do in those ball screen situations. And if Arkansas gets out and pushes a little bit, it's always good to have another guy who can run that wing and kind of be aggressive attacking the rim, or at least get himself to the line.
He's a really, really athletic dude.
Really, really athletic dude. Can get on the glass, too. Kind of help them kind of shore up the rebound margin a little bit. Also really interested to see how well Moses Moody plays. I'm a big fan of Moody. He's struggled against like teams that I think are over 500. He's only averaging 15 points per game, but his three-point shooting percentage dips by about 5 or 6 points. Sometimes they go away from him a little bit. He's not always the most assertive guy. He's more of a catch-and-shoot option. So curious if Moody shows up and has a real impact on the game, whether that's shooting, whether that's using his 7-foot wingspan to get in passing lanes and create turnovers. Really interested to see what the impact of Smith is and how they defend pick and rolls, and will Moody have an impact on this game, whether it's shooting or some off-ball defense and creating some run out opportunities for them.
Well, and I think it's also worth noting how like weird of a game this was the first time Missouri played Arkansas. Now it was at Bud Walton. Mark Smith and Drew Smith combined for 14 turnovers. Missouri had 21 turnovers total. they were 19 to 32 from 2-point range. Obviously Jeremiah Tillman and Xavier Pinson had big games. So while they were shooting 60% from the rim, around the rim, Arkansas was 12 of 43 from 2-point range for a robust 28%.
Yeah.
like, I don't want to necessarily say, okay, like, you obviously you can't count him repeating that. I don't think you necessarily even think about, you know, can we repeat that kind of game. I think if you're Missouri, you're looking just as much at Mark Smith and Drew Smith.
Wanting him to value the ball.
Yeah, giving the ball away 14 times. And if you can, like, let's say Drew Smith turns the ball over 3 times and Mark Smith, you know, turns it over 4 times. Well, that's, you know, like, that's cutting that in half. So that's 7 more possessions in a game where you were averaging 1 point, you know, per possession. And so, okay, so that's going to put them a lot closer to 90 points for the game. And so now, like, if Arkansas shoots a little better, you know, let's get back to kind of like their averages. Now it's a little bit more of a competitive game. And so I think this is something that, you can definitely like look at the first game and say, okay, like this is how we are going to defend them. This is what we're going to try to do, to prevent them from scoring. I think, you know, Mizzou can kind of give Sills and Tate, and Note like a lot of trouble around the rim. But you also got to play better offensively. Like, I don't think you can necessarily count on Jeremiah Tillman going wild. I don't know that you can count on Xavier Pinson going to the line 15 times. If they do, great. But it would certainly be nice to see a little bit more of a balanced effort, see Drew Smith kind of continue the way that he's played here recently with a little bit more confidence offensively. Mark Smith, you know, for all the things that Mark Smith, you know, has sort of struggled offensively, he's just such a damn good defender. Yeah. You know, and even in that game, so he had 8 turnovers. He also had 9 rebounds. So I don't think, like, you can overlook that. And he did, like, he did make 2 threes, and one of them, like we were kind of talking about earlier, where it seems like Missouri kind of comes up with the shot at the right moment. I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, but, you know, Arkansas kind of closed the gap a little bit. Mark Smith hits a 3, and suddenly, you know, Missouri is coasting the rest of the way. So this is a game where, so this is really a week where you have a road game against a team that is a winnable road game, a home game against a team you've already beaten once. You go 2-0, and you are really setting yourself up for a really strong finish. I mean, after Mississippi, Arkansas, you get Georgia, South Carolina, Ole Miss again at home, Texas A&M, and then Florida. Yep. I just, like, I don't necessarily, like, if Missouri is going to drop a game, like, the rest of the way, like, I would, the Ole Miss game to me stands out. I think you got to find a way to beat Arkansas at home. You win 3 in a row, or sorry, 4 in a row, and then, you know, you can take a coin flip and see what happens in Florida. But
I've been consistent and adamant throughout the year. It's about getting to 10 SEC wins. You get there. I think over the last 5 or 6 years, 80% of the teams that get to that mark make the tournament. Get to 10. That's the goal. You're at 6 now. You got to go 4-3 down the stretch, get to 10 wins. With your resume, you're in. That's mission critical this year. We can talk about where you're seated or improving your seating or your ceiling. This is probably why Missouri segment of our fans thinks I'm a pessimist, but the goal is just to get into the NCAA tournament. That's mission critical right now. You want to be playing consequential basketball in March. You need 4 more wins to really all but lock that up. You're in good position right now. You're probably maximizing your seed ceiling right now. Now's not about doing any more work. It's about consolidating and shoring up the work you've already done. That's what this week is. It's, you know, putting more in savings and banking some more credibility and just doing what you need to do. The hard work, I'll probably jinx this by saying this, but the bulk of the work for building a resume is done, or we're going to be close to done at this point. If you're still hunting around for quad one wins midway through February, you're in some trouble. Missouri's not in that position. So this week's just about doing what they can to go into the final weeks of the season and consolidate what all the hard work they've put in through, you know, the first 2 months of the season.
Well, how about we just do a repeat of what we did last week? Win two games, maybe in less heart-wrenching fashion on the weekend. Missouri also has an unbeaten streak in the Rally for Ryan game, so they got to hold that up at the very least.
And you know what people also got to do? Cut some checks, get the credit cards out, make a donation for pediatric cancer research. Got to do that.
Well, so Rockin' Nation is running a very fun, Matt. It's very fun little fundraiser. We put the fun in fundraiser with Rally for Ryan. We did this last year, kind of talked to Brad Lewis about it, and we kind of worked out a fun little thing. So if you head over to rockemnation.com, you'll see a link for the Rock'em Nation Rally for Ryan pledge drive. Please sign up. Everything is going to Rally for Ryan, which is doing what it can to fight and research cures for pediatric cancer, which Matt is the number one killer for children. So it's one of those things that where you kind of want to fix that, right?
Oh yeah, from having part of my work deals with this, it's, you would think that sometimes pediatric cancer research gets a lot of money. Sometimes it doesn't, because a lot of times the families that are experiencing this are not well off. That's the insidious nature of this. It hits all socioeconomic levels. So if you have grateful patients, sometimes they are raising a family and they may not have a lot of money to give to support research. You're also looking at, still even comparatively to other cancers, a small pool of people. And so while we all think it's awful, it's still a relatively modest research area compared to some other ones. So that's hard to raise money for. It's great that Missouri does this. It's great the athletic department puts its weight behind it. And I can say this from having seen families who benefit from this research, especially in immunotherapy here at Indiana University, which is a big thing. It matters to know that there are people out there that support you, that want to make the best treatments, the best diagnostics, and the best care available is something that heartens them. So whatever we can do, whatever you can do to give them that hope and to give great clinicians and great physicians and oncologists resources, do it. That's all I can say. Just do it. You'll feel all the better for it.
Yeah, and as I even said in the post, we don't care how the money gets there, just that it gets there. So if you just want to skip the fundraiser altogether and just donate directly to Rally for Ryan, there is a link to do so in the post. So go to Rock'em Nation and do that. I'd like to see a whole lot of folks signed up for it. That's all we're going to do this week. We're already over an hour. Damn it, Matt, we went over an hour again. But we will be back next week, because we will have to review what happened against Ole Miss and in Arkansas, and previewing the next week's game. So if you have any complaints, anything that you want us to know about, please at Mitch on Twitter, and I guess confess all your sins there. If you have any questions that you want us to answer, you can always hit Matt or me up on Twitter. He is Matt JHarris85. I am Sam T. Snelling. Or you can just at Rock'em Nation. That works too. Because I'm there tweeting straight fire these days, Matt. Straight fire. That's what the kids say, right? Until next week, thanks for tuning in.